This evening, we're going to have something a little bit different than the normal Dhamma talk. So because it being the 28th anniversary of Abhayagiri, we thought to have the senior monks in order, starting with Lungpa, give some recollections, reflections about the years at Abhayagiri, and then we'll go down the line. Ajahn Kurudamo, Ajahn Seik said pass. So we'll Nimo and Lungpa and see how it goes.
Okay.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namasami. Well, first of all, just to express my amazement that it's already 28 years. And although, you know, it depends on the day, sometimes it seems longer, sometimes it seems shorter. But the yeah, 28 years is a not insubstantial. And I gave the reflection this morning to the community. Just that the monastery is really the kind of the sum total of the people of the community itself, as opposed to the kind of the physical land or buildings, and it's the community and the people that are what is what really creates the monastery. And I think it's important to recollect that this is, you know, what we experience today as Abhayagiri has been built on, you know, the cumulative efforts of many, many people and many people's involvement over these, not just 28 years, but I mean, 28 years as Abhayagiri, but the vision of Abhayagiri began before then with the Sangapala Foundation hosting the monks and asking the involvement of Lungpa Samedo to give his blessing to have a branch monastery of Ajahn Chah here in America. And it was only later that I started to get wind of it in Thailand and meeting people over the years. But so, you know, certainly a shout out to Daniel Barnes, who most people won't know, but he was the one who had the kind of the vision and rustled together people to form Sangapala Foundation in order to have a monastery. And then, of course, Debbie Stamp was on that first board and is still involved in the monastery. And these days she doesn't get to spend as much time as she would like here because she's been helping look after her father, but she's been involved since day one. So, I think, Suhi, you were on the Sangapala Foundation before Abhayagiri was established as well. So it's that's not a small thing. It's good to remember the kind of the roots in the background. And of course, Ajahn Kurudamo, as a lay person, served as a steward for the hosting the Ajahn Amaro and a couple of the other monks in San Francisco. So that would have been early 1990s, so that they're very before the days. So yeah, it's built bit by various people's efforts. And the early days of were pretty simple and basic. Oh, so Ajahn Kurudamo, you were trying to set up the mailbox. You know, the tools you had were like a Swiss Army knife. and a hammer, and a Swiss Army knife and a hammer. That was the monastery toolbox. So things were pretty basic. Early days, and then wasn't it you met nature? Was it? While you're setting up the mailbox, nature was a local guy, and he came here for many, many years. So, there was a wonderful cast of characters who passed through in those early days. David Dawson, who was a local person, lived up on Cave Creek Road, further up Tomkai, up on Cave Creek Road. And he saw the monastery sign, which was in those days, was just Vihara, because they had a traveling sign when Ajahn Amaro was coming from time to time, so that it just had Vihara, which was, say, a Pali word for residence. And that was so they could use that wherever. They didn't have a name, really, so it was Vihara. And so they put that sign up, and his David Dawson, a local guy living up on a piece of property further up the driving past here, and his brother had been a Buddhist monk in Sri Lanka, so he knew what a Vihara was, so he stopped in, and then he helped out for early years. It was very instrumental in helping us build our very first kutis. His passion was... he was a good builder, but his passion was making trails. So he was very instrumental in helping us start the trail, system of trails that we have in the monastery, which is a huge amount of work that took place over these years. So that sense of these people who helped to gave time and effort and energy and goodwill towards helping make Abhayagiri be the place that it is. And then, very humble beginnings, so we really didn't, starting with a very basic toolkit. And then not being able to, just not having the funds to build very much in the beginning. And then even as we had some funds, we still didn't have permission to build. So we had a whole bunch of trailers, and it was like a Buddhist trailer park. And the Mariah and your family used to come when you're very early, probably after, but in the first year or so, started coming, and you saw those. It'd be the Buddhist trailer park, as we used to call it, because the Vihara, the R Vihara. Yeah. So it was not a grandiose sort of plan, but there was a tremendous sense of willingness of people to come and participate and help out and be a part of this. And so it's grown to this day, and time passes. I'm just sort of thinking, it just was only a few days ago that the lawyer who was very instrumental in helping us, shepherd us through the process of getting a change of use permit and receive permission to be a monastery. She just recently passed away. We were at her funeral ceremonies in Boonville just a few days ago. So that... And then our contractor and project managers who gave us really good guidance and all these structures and buildings which are so well done and well thought through, and because of them. And they've since passed away. So the time marches on, of course, today was a day long on Anapanasati and Maranasati, so the recollection of death. And as we come into this sphere, I think one of the things to recollect is, what good can we leave for others? Because we're we have this opportunity. And yeah, in one of the reflections, my life is uncertain, my death is certain, but that's not a reason to be depressed and miserable. It's sort of, oh, and it is, death is certain. Well, what good can we leave for others? So that's a reflection for today.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Just thinking of before I became a monk, one of the places that I worked was a day program for older and disabled people. And one of the therapeutic groups that we would have there, usually led by one of the social workers, was the reminiscence group, memory group, specifically designed to help us or help the older folks, those older folks, successfully complete Erik Erikson's eighth stage of psychological development, integrity versus despair. So, you accomplish this by integrating the past into your current situation as you age and getting closer to death, and the successful result is when you become fully ego integrated through this kind of recollection and reminiscing. So all of you out there who are listening to us with kind hearts and thinking good thoughts are contributing to all of us who are reminiscing here so that we don't enter into despair. there's so much, memories for myself, starting back before the monastery opened and being a lay follower and slowly over time developing an interest in this tradition, getting to meet Ajahn Amaro in the early days, Ajahn Sumedho, of course, when they would come to do short retreats and stay for longer periods of time here on the invitation of Sangapala. And then just a little bit later into that process, Lumbar Pasano appearing on the scene every now and then, getting to meet him. And then finally deciding or thinking that I wanted to join the monastic life and having the opportunity to go to Thailand in the winter of 95-96 to Wat Phananachat. And to my good fortune, finding not only Lungpor Pasano there, but Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Amaro were there at the same time. Ajahn Sumedho leading a retreat for the Wat Phananachat community, Ajahn Amaro attending him and helping out as well. So the three of them were there that winter, and I was going there to try and make a decision of whether to ordain or not, and it was my first time in Thailand. And I remember after a long process and the retreat that Lumbar Sumedho led, that I decided, okay, well, I think I'm ready to make that decision, and talked with Ajahn Amaro, found Ajahn Amaro to talk with him about it, and basically telling him that I had decided to do that, and my only choice that I now needed to make was whether to ordain in Thailand with Ajahn Pasano there, or whether to maybe go to England with Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Amaro. And he said, well, can you keep a secret? I said, oh, well, I guess so. And he said, well, I'll give you a third opportunity to go maybe and help us start Abhayagiri. Well, he didn't have the name Abhayagiri, but to start the monastery in California, because I've just been given permission to do that. And this is after some years of planning in this direction. And so I was like, oh my gosh, okay, a third option. So Ajahn Sumedho in England, Ajahn Pasano in Thailand, or Ajahn Amaro in California. And I think Ajahn Amaro could see my wheels turning, not able to really quite make a decision about that, at least at that time. And then he kind of picked up on that, I think. And then he said, can you keep another secret? I said, okay. And he said, well, nobody knows this other than a very few people, and you have to promise not to tell anybody because it's not made public yet, but Ajahn Pasano has agreed to come and take up residence at Abhaya, or at the new monastery as well, although there would be a bit of a time delay probably. And it's like, okay, well, that's the deal breaker. I get two for one. So as much as I would have loved spending time at Amaravati and being there with Ajahn Sumedho, it seemed like a fairly easy decision after a few days of deliberation to come and join the community here. The to-be community here hadn't opened yet. This was in December, January of 95-96, and we opened here 6 months later. So, yeah, just what an incredible series of events coming together in my life to make it all possible and to be able to join in a community with such excellent leadership right from the very start. Yeah, it's really hard to tell, you know, just in a few minutes, the both the challenges and the benefits, all that I received from those first few years, myself and Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Vasudi at the time, the three of us. This was 6 months before Lumpa was able to come and join us in June of 96 when we opened up the monastery. And I hadn't been up on the property before. We took my Anagarika ordination in San Francisco on May 31st that night at Mark Lieberman's house. Debbie, of course, was there, as well as Mark Sponseller, I think, who later joined the community for a while. And anyway, driving up the next morning in my new whites, Ajahn Amaro's comment as we turned onto Tamakai Road, he said, "This is all very new right now, but we'll all look extremely familiar in a very short time." And he was right. And then opening up the monastery with our small house and little shed and garage, which is now the dining hall. And the three of us and a few lay supporters. Paul Friedlander giving us our first refrigerator, because all we had was a cooler ice chest for refrigeration at the time. But and then, of course, Suhi, on the beginning days as the treasurer, Sangapala. Others, many others. And just that sense of, you know, we were so busy and there was so much to do, so much learning the ropes of things like blackberry bramble and poison oak and clearing trails and setting up tents, living in the little house for the first few weeks, the three of us, two-bedroom house, and myself camped out in the living room. But it didn't at all seem like a burden in any way. It was... there was just too much to do to even think of anything as a burden. But right from the beginning, with Ajahn Amaro and then later with Lumpa Pasano coming on, keeping always the development of monastics, the training of monastics as the primary goal, the primary motivation. Always, of course, with welcoming the lay community to come and join us and learn from the teachings, from the lifestyle of being in a monastery, but with that commitment, that sense right from the get-go of this is going to be a training monastery, this is going to be a place to support the development of monastics first and foremost, and not to, you know, start a retreat center or immediately branch out to teaching retreats all over the country, that kind of thing, although, of course, that started to evolve over time. But first and foremost, this is a training monastery for monastics, and that we always have to keep that at the heart of what we're doing here. And then let the rest spill out from that. If we keep that as our goal, as our primary MO, then whatever comes in addition to that or from that will be coming from a much purer space than if we set out this intention to, you know, convert America into... The truth, the Buddhist Dharma. Come and listen to the good word. But keeping the monastic training at the heart. So I've always appreciated both Ajahn Amaro's and Lumpa Pasano's emphasis on that. And that to me spoke you know, more to the sense of integrity that I was looking for. And yeah, I think it's that's still the overall writing MO that we have here. And again, we can see the flourishing lay community and the teachings that have branched out from that. But they're always here in the from the early days right up to the present moment. The people here, the training, the monastic community, and the commitment to living the life as close as we can to as to the way the Buddha set it up more than 2,500 years ago, almost 2,600 years ago now. And keeping to that structure, keeping to that form, and what flows from that will have the greatest impact on the world around us. So I'll just leave it there with a few memories for now.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Whenever I reminisce about the past of a Bhayagiri, I tend to fill in gaps that Lompa Pisano and Ajahn Kurudamo never talk about. They tend to talk about those beginning years. So I got here in year 5, so those were starting to get in some of the middling years of a Bhayagiri. And some of the reflections coming up for me around just listening to Lompa and Ajahn Kurudamo speak, and some of the recollections coming up for me were around just how supportive this community was of me when I first came here, and some of the lay people, some of the characters who were around, and the lay of the land at that time in 2001, June 2001. So Bhayagiri had just turned 5 at that time. And I'll use people's honorifics that they were at that time. So Tan Kurunadamo was spending his 3rd Vasa away in England with Longpo Samedo at that time. So you did get to spend time with mostly Ajahn Suchito, okay. With Ajahn Sumedho as well. Was that at Chidhurst? Yes, at Chidhurst, 3rd Vasa away. So he wasn't here when I got here. And also there was a name I kept hearing, Tan Sudanto, also wasn't here. He actually had been here helping establish the monastery, but he was in Thailand. I decided to go Tudong for a while, and he ended up coming back when I was about halfway through my Anagarika year. As well as Tan Kurunadamo came back, 3 Vasas, and that was also during my Anagarika year. And I just remember arriving as a lay person, and we used to have tea in the little house that doesn't exist anymore. And that little house was kind of the beating heart of a Bhayagiri, and there was the front porch, the green chairs, which still do exist. We still have the green chairs. And we would sit on the front porch, drink tea. And I remember there was a woman who had been living here for a period of time. She was in white, actually. What was her name? She was here at the same time Robert Hahn was here. She was in white, though, for... It wasn't Moria, was it? No, it wasn't Moria. Maureen. Maureen. Yes. Yes. Yeah, that was her. So she had just left the whites when I got here. And I remember having tea with her. I saw her there. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So we've stayed in contact. But I remember she was one of the first people I talked to in the monastery, actually, apart from Debbie. And I remember sitting in the little house having tea and just kind of starting to meet people. I'd been here for a couple days. And I remember she asked me, oh, what's your intention in coming here? And I said, well, I'm actually thinking about ordaining. And she said, she kind of surprised me. But, sadhu, it's the highest thing in the world. I said, oh, okay, that's interesting. And she had so much faith. And then I remember meeting Debbie. And then I said, oh, you live here. And she said, yeah, I've been here since the beginning. And I said, oh, why aren't you ordained? And then she said, it's a long story. So she did. She was very diplomatic. And then 2 Siladharas were here. Sister Sundara and Sister Jitindriya were here at that time. and there was a monk who I didn't realize was about to disrobe. His name was Piacilo. He was the work monk. And then the guest monk was named Tan Achalo. So all these characters were here at that time. And then I was very intense, very impulsive, very idealistic. And the email I had written to the guest monk, to Tan Achalo, was, "I want to ordain. What do I do?" Didn't sign it. And then he almost didn't respond because one of the other monks, who I won't name, was walking by and said, "Oh, I would just delete that email." And then Tan Achalo said, "No, you never know. You never know." So he responded. So I have him to thank for being here. And then also one of the funny interactions I had with then Tan Achalo when I was here, he was super meta with me and trying to really befriend me and just kind of make me feel comfortable. And I remember I turned to him. He was walking up the hill with me and just asking, you know, "Are you doing okay? How's everything going?" And he recollected this to me later, and I feel so embarrassed even telling the story. But I said, "Look, I'm not here to make friends, all right?" I said, "I'm here to practice. I'm not here to make friends." He's like, "All right, all right." Didn't quite understand the whole Kalyanamitta thing yet. But people were very, very supportive of me. The person who was the most supportive of me, I have to back up a little bit. I came here in May of 2001, just before Bayagiri turned 5, and I was here as a guest for a week first, and only then Ajahn Pasano, not Longpa yet, Ajahn Pasano was here. Ajahn Amaro was teaching in New York, so he was away. So actually, even backing up more, the first monk I ever met via phone was Ajahn Amaro, because I called Abayagiri before I sent that email. I called Abayagiri and Ajahn Amaro picked up. And he said, "Hello." I said, "Thinking about ordaining? Is this something?" He's like, "Well, we aren't exactly recruiting people, but you're welcome to email the guest monk and visit." So, click. So, I don't think he just... "Okay, thanks. Okay, bye." So that's when I sent that email. And then the first monk I met in person was Tan Achalo. But then Ajahn Pasano was the only one here. And I would go in for tea time in what was the Dhamma Hall, which is now the dining hall. And it would just be me sitting there. There was nobody there. There was nobody in the monastery. It was empty. It was just very, very quiet. I think there was 7 people living here at the time, and maybe 8 or 9 if you included the guests. I was here for a whole week, and it seemed like it was just me and Ajahn Pasano every day. He answered all my questions. I mean, now that I know Thai, I could say I was Mai Lu Luang. Like, I had no idea what was happening. He answered all my questions, was very gracious, very generous. And, you know, I had no idea. He was a famous monk in Thailand and super senior, and what kind of respect you were supposed to show to seniority. But I did feel after that visit that, wow, you know, this place with the kutis and the land and this Ajahn who is just kind of so gracious, and I'm just some guy coming off the street, and he answered all my questions. And then one of the last things, the last day, I said, "Well, now there's a fork in the road. I could go back to my life, or I could come here." And his advice to me was, "Don't think about it too much." Really, really good advice. And just that openness really made me want to come back. So then I ended up, and also very practical. So I said, "Well, can I request to come be an Anagarika?" And he said, "Well, there was another guy who was supposed to show up and he didn't show, and you're here and he's not here. So yeah, you can become an Anagarika." So very practical. So, oh, okay. I like that. That guy did show up later, though, and was junior to me then. That was Chris Bradley. And the Anagarika senior to me was Scott Boltinghouse, who became Obaso and was a monk for a year. So, that was the lay of the land when I got here, and I just feel very grateful. There's just one other person I wanted to talk about who I met when I first came here, and that was an elderly woman who was living here, and her name was Kitty Engel. And she also was super metta with me and really kind of talked with me quite a bit, took me in. And then I remember in my kind of intensity, I was told her one day, like, yeah, I can't turn back now. I'm just gonna stay here. You know, I left all my friends behind and I'm just gonna practice as hard as I can. And she was like, don't say that. You have to be more open. Come on, be kinder to yourself. She's giving me that encouragement. So just remembering some of these characters from the early days, and I think that's good enough for now. I'll pass it on to Ajahn Chunda.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ anuttaraṃ upājjayaṃ namāsāmi. I think I started visiting Abhayagiri as a lay guest in 2003, and I'd heard of Abhayagiri at Spirit Rock. I think Sylvia Borstein was talking about how much she was admiring Ajahn Amaro's bowl, and I was intrigued to come up here. But I think I actually first heard about Abhayagiri in about 1998 when a college professor actually told me that she had gone up to some forest monastery in northern Mendocino. And I said, oh, what, like CTTB? And she said, no, it's somewhere around there. And there were these nice Western monks actually living there. And so I was quite surprised. And that was my first encounter with just hearing about Abhayagiri. But I didn't go for another 5 years. And thinking by the time I got here, there was, I think they had around that time, so that's about 7 years from when it started, there was already about 8 or 9 kutis. I think the yurts were built and the straw bale, but there were still the few RVs left. And so I was able to actually stay in one of those when I came later to stay longer term. So the first monk I met was here at Abhayagiri was Tan Kurunadamo, who I think was 2003 would be 5 Vasa then. And I was asking lots of questions, and he tailored his Dhamma talk towards answering those, so it was quite sweet. There's very few people here in those days, not that many guests. And the day I arrived first was when who Tanti Thabo was Aaron Remington. He had just become an Anagarika the day before I arrived. So that was quite special for me to talk to a newly minted Anagarika. And then on that visit, I was quite struck with the life here, and I was quite excited about it. I had kind of thought about being a monk, even though I didn't know what it meant. I think I started thinking about it when I was about 15, after reading Siddhartha. So this was kind of the first living moment of actually experiencing what monks would be like. I came back then the next year, and after that stay, and I met at that time, I think when the first time I visited, there was almost no monks here. They were going down to Wat Metta, I think, Tan Sudanto and Tan Yaniko, and maybe Darren, Anagarika Darren, the greatest Anagarika chanter we've had, or the worst. So he drove them, and so I didn't. There weren't many monks at that time, but I was kind of getting to know Abhayagiri. There was so little here. It was just like a garage that had been converted, and that was the dining hall. It was then the Dhamma hall, and then this old house, this kind of creepy or creaking old house that was just multi-use. The Ajahn's office was in there, and that's where then Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro had their office, a small little room in the house next to the library. And all of that, and the kitchen was in that house. I think when I first arrived, it was just, there wasn't even this extended kitchen. It was this tiny kitchen, and they did wash dishes on the porch in the back. I think the kitchen was no more than like maybe a 10 by 10 space or 8 by 8 space, something like that. So anyway, the next time I visited was a little bit more interesting for me because I met Tanyaniko, and I remember that I was very eager. It was just before he was going to leave for his third vasa. So I think you were two vasa at the time, 2004, and I met with Tanyaniko. And later he revealed to me his thought after I had interviewed him, and so I'm never going to see this guy again. So it was not a very flattering interview for me, impressing Tanyaniko. But yeah, I got to know, I think at that time it was, maybe that's when I got to know Anagarika Aaron, who had just started. And I also remember at that time I had my first encounter with Lumpur. And, I remember, most people know I'm quite, I have quite the voice on me and very wordy. And, I was talking with, we can call it talking, with Aaron, Anagarika Aaron and Ginger at the time he was here. And at 6:30 p.m., Lumpur walks in. He says, "Do you guys realize the kitchen windows were open?" I said, "No, we didn't think about that." And also the dining hall windows were open. Those were the Dhamma hall windows, little hall there. And I'm like, he keeps saying these things. I'm like, "Oh no." And he says, "I couldn't hear the guests asking me the questions based on how loud the three of you were." And I was just like, "Oh God, I'm never going to be allowed to visit it again." But I was, so that was very kind, Lumpur. Yeah, so eventually I think I came in 2005 to settle in, lived down the road for a little bit. There was, in those days, the total number of men was 13. I was allowed to have 13 residents at the time because the phase, we hadn't moved our phases yet in terms of like, or passed into the next phase of building. So I had to be down the street. And I think I was probably the only, Lumpur asked me to be the kitchen manager, even though I was still living down the street. So I took a lot of pride in that. And, so that was a lot of fun for me. That was the first winter retreat, but it started a bit chaotic with torrential downpours, and Lumpur and Ajahn Amar were gone, I think. And Ajahn Tan Krunadamo was, and Tansudan. So all I was here was Tankrun Damo in, I think it was December and early January, and the rains were so heavy that we were having these landslides, and it was pretty crazy. And I remember one night we went up around, it must have been, I think we were going up around 11 or 12, and it was just drenching rain. And we came to this point where like there was this major landslide, and there was a monk named, Choti, what was his name, from Wat Nanachat, he was five vasa. He'd come from Ajahn Brahms, but he was American lawyer. Satimanto. And so we're sitting in the back, the retreat crew sitting in the back of the truck. We come to this, this landslide, and it's almost midnight or something, and it's so cold, and it's raining so hard. And Satimanto says to Tankrun Damo, who's in charge, "Well, let's just ask these laymen to get out of the truck and just dig this thing out." I mean, this was a major landslide. And I'm sitting there, the hood is over my head. I'm like looking down. There's no volunteering going on at this point. And it's just like the rain's coming down. And I'm like, "Oh God, no." So I wasn't really kind of feeling very generous in those days. And very sweetly, Tankrun Adamo said, "I'm not going to ask them to do that." And so I think we drove by it or all got out. I can't remember. But anyway, eventually we did dig it out. I think one of the Frys came, maybe Luke Fry came and dug a lot of those out for us. So yeah, so it was quite a sweet time. But they were early days, so things were quite more rudimentary then. I remember we had two porta potties right out here. Those were our extra two toilets that we had. There was only one toilet in the whole monastery, in addition to the women's bathhouse. So that was shared amongst all of the residents. So we had these two porta potties. And I remember one day, the winds were strong and one of them got blown over. And I was so excited. I was like, "Wow, that's great." And that was the kind of exciting things that happened in the monastery those days. Yeah. And I started to learn, I learned about proper English then. So like I would often ask, Ajahn Amaro, I think after Lumpur left, cause he went on in his sabbatical. So they were trading times away. So when I came here, Ajahn Amaro wasn't here and Lumpur was, and Ajahn Amaro was taking a year and 3 months sabbatical. And then Lumpur was about to do that, but they were changing over for about 3 months. They had overlap. But I started to learn about English, so I had a lot of requests from Ajahn Amaro or of him, and I remember I would just ask him, can we do this, can we do that? And he would say, duly noted, and I was like, all right, duly noted, yes. It's great. And I didn't hear much from my requests after that was said, but I would still get really excited because he was, you know, I felt acknowledged and like, yeah, duly known, it sounds good. And then I remember 10 years later in 2017 at the EM that I was at, the International Elders Conference or meeting, there was this piece of paper being distributed that said, like, this is what people were given, the Americans were given in the war in the mid-40s, early 40s, so they could translate what the English had said. And I said, oh, look, duly noted. And then I went over and I looked at the American translation and it said, I've registered what you've said and I plan to do nothing about it. And I was like, wow, like, I can't believe it. Like, this is like 12 years later. I found some humor in it, so I didn't kind of go to Ajahn Amaro and be like, I can't believe you said this to me. I figured it out then. Yeah, and so there was a lot of, sometimes I thought about sometimes being like faulty towers, some of the kind of fun communications and things that occurred in those days. They were very sweet and good times. And it was interesting because my first experience was just with Ajahn Amaro. I had a little bit of time with Lumpur before he left, but not much. And then I was, my anagarchy year was a lot of training by Ajahn Amaro. And so then I got to see for the next 4 years, with the two of them together. And that, although we haven't mentioned it, because it's sort of, I think, part of our collective memories, those who started early, there was something very special about that time, having the co-abbots, having the two of them together. And yeah, I found that, like, we would often talk about the ma and pa syndrome and the fact that, like, if you, you know, you, there was a tendency for some of the monks to be like, okay, if I want to get this answered in the affirmative, then I got to go to Ma Amaro or Pa Pasano. So we would kind of, okay, who am I going to go to first? But they, you know, they tended to also just get to know their students pretty quickly. And so I learned that, you know, they were both training us in different ways, but really, like, because they had very different personalities and ways of approaching things, it was much more of a rounded training. And it wasn't until later, because a lot of times it's, the training can be quite painful if, you know, like for me, like not recognizing, like, okay, I was acting out of desire a lot. And then, you know, I was getting that thwarted because that's what the abbot is really supposed to do. They're not supposed to just satisfy your desire. That wouldn't be helpful. So a lot of times it was painful. But it was a very good way of training, really having the two of them. And that's how it was, I think, for, was it 96 to 2010? So for 14 years. And so that was a very special aspect of Abhaya Giri. It continued for quite a long time. And I think it was a pioneering thing at the time. There wasn't, even still, there's very rare to have co-abbots. But at that time, I think there were very few. Lumpur remarked, there's a Thai phrase, something about, why would you want to have two tigers in one cave? So it's like the fact that the two of them lived together in harmony and really taught us in harmony and were together in how they were teaching. It was just a very special time of training. So I think that for me brings a lot of joy when I think about it. And then after Ajahn Amaro left, though, it was nice that Lumpur encouraged other senior monks to fill in that role that Ajahn Amaro left behind. And so we had like Ajahn Yatiko and Ajahn Gurudamo really filled in with that in quite a bit. And those early days, they were very special for me because there's something about the first few years of practice that can seem sometimes insurmountable. I remember asking Ajahn Amaro, I've shared this with others several times, I was saying, gosh, Sanagarki is really hard. And he said, oh, don't worry, you know, the first 20 years are the hardest. And I just thought that's a joke, right? And he, no, not really. I just, oh, that's so sad. but I, you know, I really, you know, treasured those years and was very happy with my choice to stay on. And I wasn't sure that I would. In fact, going back a little bit, the other funny thing that happened with Tanyaniko and I is that when I went to go pick him up at the airport from his time away in Thailand, he had not seen or heard from me after our first wonderful interview. And then he comes out of the gate and he sees me and he goes, "You? You became an anagarika? I can't believe it." I was, yeah. Let's go get some lunch. So, yeah, so we did. But that actually started a very beautiful friendship that's lasted a long time. So I hope he's not still thinking about that every day. I can't believe it. But yeah, so there was a lot of good times to those days. Those were when Tansan Bhajana was here, very colorful days, and then Tanti Thabo and also who hasn't been mentioned much is Jay. Jay was a very special man who he really changed over the years. He came to the monastery in not a very good state, and he'd been at CTTB, and he wasn't in a very good way, and Ajahn Yanako, through a couple of agreements, said, "Okay, you can stay the night." And then it kind of got longer. And then eventually he ended up staying on for a while. And then he went over across the street near Dennis's land. And he stayed over there. And he just became a fixture for, I think it was like 6 years. And he would come about every other day. He'd help with the cooking, looked after us, the Anagarikas, and Ming An at the time, who is now Ajahn Kasapo. So his Anagarika Ming An was nervous in cooking. He didn't like to cook. And so Jay would come in and he would just say, "I'll just make some cookies." And then he would do the whole meal. And so that was another special person in our life that some of the monks and lady who are around now may not know about. But those from the older times, he was definitely a person who looked after us quite well. And he had a bit of a gruff personality, but he always behind that was this kind of very big heart. And he ended up dying after being here. And we looked after him somewhat during that time. So that was a very good friend of the monastery. And so I think, not to go too late, I'll pass this on. Thank you for listening.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I arrived at Baigiri in 2007, which is year 11 of a Baigiri, and originally, and just tend to stop by and then go to see other monasteries, but end up just staying, and glad I did. And looking back, I appreciate the comment, reflection offered earlier that monasteries, the people, appreciate the sense of community at a Baigiri. I remember there's this room on the corner, which is now the Terrace Vestry. It's by the standing wooden Buddha, and we used to have sort of heart meetings or circle meetings in there in the early days, and it'd be like Ajahn Pasno, Ajahn Amro, and Debbie, and then Samanera Chunda, and then Anagarika Wit, and myself. It was then Anagarika Nick. Yeah, just the general encouragement through all the ups and downs and doubts. And now it's another place that's quite meaningful is the, now it's called the Monk's Dining Hall, but in my kind of prefer to still refer to it as the old Dhamma Hall. It's where I had the Anagarika ceremony and Samanera going forth, and was the, in some ways also felt like the heart of the community. It was many things, and big part of the weekend or schedule or rhythm in the early years was the Wan Pra vigil, very consistent. And it was both, every lunar observance day, or almost every, staying up, and then first part of the night was kind of okay or enjoyable, and then midnight tea, which was very nice with Ajahn Pasno and Ajahn Amro and gathering around and the trays, and very nice, but then also that sense of dread of when it's going to end, and then there's going to be that dreaded period between midnight tea and the morning chanting at 3 a.m., which was always found quite difficult. but also remember some, but also this feeling of worthwhile, like many things, during time in Abhayagiri, challenging, but also worthwhile feel, opportunity for growth. And one, there'd be one memorable teaching. I remember I was maybe, anagarika or a novice, and I was sitting on the left side, as I remember it, on the wall somewhere. And I was asking Ajahn Amaro, well, why do some people stay and some people go? And Ajahn Amaro was like, well, you have to realize there's going to be ups and downs and inspiration and lack of inspiration and all sorts of things like that. And but just realize there are going to be different phases. So when you go through them, just be able to reflect on that and not to just stick it out. And I found it's been very helpful, useful reflection over the years. And so, yeah, just appreciate the sense of family and, since it's extended family, sense of community. Remember, see people, monastics, lay people you don't have connections with for at this point, maybe, yes, many years, and people appearing and disappearing, and but still that long-term sense of extended family that's now grown up. So around this Abhayagiri. So just some few thoughts for this evening.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Bhutang tamang sanghang namasami.
So recently I was looking at some old photo galleries online, and I just happened to flip through some of the older photo galleries that are on our website, and I noticed the gallery from the year 2011, and that was the year that I first moved here to Abhayagiri, and just opening that gallery and taking a look at those pictures, I was immediately drawn back to a time that I had really forgotten about. And I realized that so many of the memories and the emotions that I had when I first came here, those are things that I haven't really recollected for a long time. And going through that whole year and in pictures and the different people who were here at that time and the different events that happened, it brought up so many emotions for me, so many different perceptions. And I realized that, back then, about 13, 14 years ago, this was a very different place, and I was also a very different person. And seeing these pictures, really brought up the experience that was my own personal experience, and I think is probably shared by so many people when we first come here. Our first year, our first several years, they tend to be incredibly difficult, filled with a lot of challenges. And especially for me, when I look back at the pictures from that year, I feel a lot of, just a lot of suffering, the very difficult mental states that arose during that time. And I'm, brought back to a time when it seemed like, everything here was difficult. Although at that time the monastery had become quite comfortable to live in for someone like me, coming from the world and not being used to living in a place like this and not being used to following the renunciate precepts, there were incredible challenges every day, and so many things were just completely new for me, things that I had never experienced before. Having to live in a community of people, with many different types of people. And before coming here, I had never had to live with more than one person or a few people. And then coming to live in a community of people, and maybe you don't really get along with everyone who's here, and maybe you might not even really like everyone that you have to live with, but somehow you have to make it work, and you have to interact with these people on a daily basis. And that was incredibly challenging for me. There's also so many things that you're asked to do here at the monastery that many people maybe are not accustomed to. And for me, you know, I, coming from a life in which I had still have basically no kind of practical skills at all, you know, being asked to do so many different things here, you know, things like line trimming or kind of, you know, different kind of repairs or working on different things and just feeling completely lost, you know, having to work in the kitchen. And having basically no experience with cooking at all, just being completely hopeless in the kitchen, and then kind of being assigned to, you know, be the head cook for the day. And I think it was seemed like there were oftentimes some kind of groans coming from the community when they assigned me to to be the head cook. But people were very, yeah, people were very good and not really being too vocal about complaining. But there was definitely kind of an undercurrent coming. And there are many, I think, many stories I could tell about that, but it's kind of embarrassing. Don't want to embarrass myself too much. But yeah, it was definitely, you know, it was difficult for me, probably difficult for the community. But, you know, in the end, it kind of did manage to get through it. And yeah, you know, through all of the challenges and the, you know, incredible suffering, dark states of mind through that year, you know, and recollecting that for a number of years, you know, I always would come to tea time and listen to Lumbar Pasano. Back in those days, he, you know, he was there almost every night doing tea time. And it was kind of, you know, just such a refreshing experience in the midst of a very dark world, a very dark a year, especially the first year. So that, you know, although my own personal experience was of great difficulty, you know, there was always this light there that I could tap into and, just to see somebody that was, yeah, actually happy, you know, to see like it is possible, you know, although this is my current experience, then, you know, it is possible to change oneself. So reflecting on, yeah, the past 28 years and from, you know, what we've heard, the other Ajahn's share, you know, so many things have changed in the monastery, the buildings and the people, and, you know, many things have changed, but I also like to reflect that there are some things that haven't changed, you know, about this place, and the practice that we do here, it hasn't changed, and the purpose of a monastery, you know, the purpose of a Bayagiri hasn't changed either, and, you know, this place is very much like a refuge, you know, a refuge for people. It's kind of like an oasis in the middle of a desert. And, you know, the world that we live in before we come here, for many of us, it's, you know, it's quite a dark world, you know, a world of greed, hatred, and delusion. And coming to a place like this, you know, this place is really like an oasis in the middle of the desert that we're able to take refuge in. And in the beginning, taking physical refuge in this place, being able to retreat from the world, but then eventually learning how to use this practice to find the, yeah, place of refuge, an oasis within our own heart, within our own mind, learning how to navigate the internal desert, you know, the greed, hatred, and delusion that exists within our own mind, and how to find the refuge, the place of safety, and the real place of happiness within our own heart. So these are just a few more reflections to add for this evening. Go ahead.